Welcome to the Out of the Basement podcast with Devrim Turak, Patrick Gleason, and Paul Sanders. And now, here's the show.
Hi, good afternoon to Out of the Basement interview with John Inzinus, who is a local swordsman, we could say, involved with the Society for Creative Anachronism and everything. How are you doing, John?
I'm doing pretty good. Thank you, Pat.
So, I know you've been doing gaming and the SCA stuff for quite a long time, but I didn't realize, how much you also do the sword fighting besides the Society for Creative Anachronism stuff. The Society for Creative Anachronism is sort of a medieval recreation.
I like to call it recreationists. We are medievalists in the sense of the word that we think medieval stuff is cool, and we try and recreate many aspects of it that interest us. And it's a really big tent organization, so there's lots of room for everybody who is interested in aspects of medieval material culture and social culture.
I know it's been around for a long time as well, right?
This is the 51st year of the society. Started in March this year. It's not April quite yet.
No.
So last year was sort of the 50th anniversary celebration. There were a bunch of big events all over the U.S. I don't know if they did any in Europe or any of the other places where the society is spread.
Yeah, so it's sort of the original cosplay almost, except cosplay with live role playing.
It started at Berkeley University with a costume party. That was sort of the initial event, and then it just kind of, people thought that was cool, so they kept having the parties, and there was a lot of cross-pollination with sci-fi fandom.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And it spread through that, and then a lot of members of the U.S. Armed Forces got involved, and it's spread globally through them.
And there's the recreation and stuff, because we've been to fairs where they do the tapestries, the baking, and all that sort of stuff. But the sword fighting or the melee fighting is one of the big aspects of the society, is it not?
Yeah, there's a number of different styles of combat in the SCA. The two big ones, the biggest one is what they call rattan combat or armored combat, or sometimes they call it heavy fighting. And it involves using rattan to create weapon simulators and beating each other. it's pretty neat. That's not the stuff that I do. I've tried it, and it's awesome, but there's only so much time. So the stuff that I do is it's fencing or rapier. Some people call it light combat. And it's looking more to recreate the later period combat. So for the most part, rapiers, although there are people who fight with long swords or grosse messers or that sort of thing. And that's where I got involved in more historical study of martial arts in general.
Yeah, because I was reading you're actually involved with the Ottawa Sword Team or Sword Play Group.
Ottawa Sword Play, yeah.
Yeah. So now, I know also you've been gaming for a long time as well. Like, you started in high school, I believe.
Oh, no. I started summer after elementary school, maybe.
Oh, really? Oh, wow, that long.
Grade 6, grade 7, yeah. Yeah, the first time I played D&D, I was at French camp, and there was a guy in my cabin, and he was really into D&D, and because you weren't supposed to speak English,
yeah,
we kind of hid in the woods, and nobody had any dice, so we carved notches out of our hexagonal pencils to make D6s.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So that was the first time I played D&D, and I thought that was really cool, and then I got some books and started playing D&D and got into some other games as well, GURPS and Champions.
GURPS, Champions, yeah. The more open-ended sort of games where you can play different types of genres.
More generic system stuff.
Yeah. Do you still remember your first character you played back in that camp?
Oh, no, I haven't got a clue.
No. I figured you'd be able to remember the first.
Probably an elf of some sort. It was a very open interpretation of the original rule set at that
point. No worries.
We didn't have any books or anything, so.
And you still, from what I understand, like, you still play D&D. You're now in the 5th edition, I believe, or are you still doing older
editions? I have not tried 5th edition yet. I've heard very good things about it from a number of my friends, but right now my group plays Pathfinder 3.5.
3.5, yes. That's quite a good
And one. We're very fond of that. We're going through the Iron crap. I don't remember.
Iron
it's
Kingdoms.
Called. Iron something. Iron,
I not Iron Kingdoms. I know there's a. That's
yeah,
a
not Iron Kingdoms. It's their science fantasy setting.
Okay,
with ray gun and crashed ancient spaceships, and I don't remember what it's called at the moment.
Well, that's sort of the old there's the spell and sorcery ones they had, where there's the spelljammer. Sort of idea where they
not quite Spelljammer, more the I think it was the Barrier Peaks.
Okay,
the old D&D module where you go and you investigate a crashed alien spaceship that crashed eons ago, and your D&D character fights robots and stuff.
And wasn't there a tie-in for a while for a couple modules between Gamma World, which was TSR way back when, and D&D? I think I remember a weird.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure back in the 80s and the early 90s, they did a bunch of different crossovers. Paranoia had a bunch of crossover adventures too.
Yes,
that was the cyberpunk paranoia crossover was probably the most interesting one for me. I was a huge fan of cyberpunk.
Yeah, I never did the paranoia cyberpunk crossover one because I like both games, both genres I've enjoyed. But I imagine that would have been pretty interesting, cyberpunk and paranoia.
It was a very violent game.
Imagine now, because I like you do all this different stuff. You're involved with IT as your main is your work, and just when I tell people that you've won an Emmy, it's actually you won a tech Emmy sort of idea.
Yep.
With your company,
high speed data transfer over IP, including the internet, I believe is the official category that we won in. So technical Emmys are a little bit different than the regular Emmys. So everybody who is nominated in the category receives an Emmy. So it's not like here's the list of the nominees and then the winner is. We actually, everybody who was in the category got an award, but we got that for working with NBC on the Olympics, which is pretty neat.
That is pretty impressive.
The Sochi Olympics was that one.
Yeah, that's pretty good. Now my question though, for like the game, because you do the gaming, the society created activism, and the swordplay, which obviously the gaming started first. But did you get into the society because of the gaming to understand more of the medieval sort of thing, or did the sword fighting come first and then from the sword fighting into this SCA? Or
I got interested in sword play and sword fighting when I was 10. I grew up in Nova Scotia, and there was a show that was on Sundays on CBC called Switchback. And it was basically here's stuff going on that's cool and that kids do and things like that. And they interviewed the Halifax Fencing Club. That's really cool, and I want to do that.
Right.
Unfortunately, I lived about an hour away from Halifax, so I didn't get to actually try it until I got to university and joined the fencing club there. And that was a lot of fun, but then the coach moved away. And we didn't really get to do very much more of that. So when I moved to Ottawa in 96, 95 or 96, I moved to Ottawa and I was looking for something to do in my spare time. So I joined the fencing club at Ottawa U, and I started reading about fencing because I was interested in fantasy and interested in, gaming and stuff like that. I was also interested in reading up on historic fencing, and there were a number of translated manuals that were available online at the time.
Mm-hmm.
So I started doing the Ottawa U Club, and it was fine for a while. And then we were about to get ready to do the electric Olympic style fencing, which is really not what I was interested in. Okay. So at that point I said, well, why don't I go check out the local SCA fencing practice? And I've been with them kind of ever since.
Oh, that's pretty interesting. So now, you know, imagine when you watch movies with sword fighting, you, because you've had so much experience with it, you must laugh at a lot of the stuff that goes on in, you know, so-called fantasy or, you know, historical movies for the sword fighting.
Oh, well, I wouldn't say laugh. I just, some things are really good and some things are less well thought through. But the goals of theatrical combat are very, very different than the goals of any sort of real martial arts. Mm. Because you're trying to present a story in and tell something about the character's arc as the fight progresses in a movie or in a theatrical
movie. As opposed to just trying to kill the guy.
Yeah. So my goal when I'm, you know, when I'm doing martial arts and I'm practicing fencing against somebody or sword fighting of any sort, my goal is to end the fight as quickly as possible. When I'm watching a fight, I have a number of friends actually who are who do theatrical combat and theatrical combat instruction. They're mm-hmm. they're quite good, but their goal is to, how do I make this look like a good fight? How do I make sure that the audience is afraid for the character, but not afraid for the actor?
Right.
How do I progress the plot with this fight? And what am I trying to show? Am I trying to show that this person is a really good fighter? Am I trying to show that they got lucky? What are my goals? So it's a whole different thing. That being said, there are some really terrible fights out there.
Yes. Okay. What's one that stands out, like one of the ones that you just groaned or just couldn't finish watching?
There was this one. Really any of the sword and sorcery stuff from the 80s.
Oh, like Highlander?
Fall into that category. But there was one really awful one, and I don't remember what movie it was in, but at one point it involves the main hero jumping up on top of the furniture and walking around the edge of the room while his opponent stands in the middle of the room just looking kind of baffled at what he's doing. And it feels like they did it kind of in one take.
Okay.
And may not have told all of the actors everything that's going on in the scene. It didn't look like it had received a great deal of practice.
Oh, okay. So sort of the ab lib thing without telling anyone else that you're going to do this. And like, what are you doing? What?
Yeah, absolutely.
And probably low production because they didn't refilm it. They just
it was not high production values.
Now, have you watched any Game of Thrones?
I have watched some Game of Thrones, yeah. And, so I've watched the first season, and I very much enjoyed the fencing instructor character. I thought he was a lot of fun. Okay. And you know, the fighting in there is not bad, but again,
it's more theatrical goals sort of
are different.
Yeah.
Than what my girls are as a historical martial art enthusiast.
Yeah. So, have you thought of trying to get into the theatrical, you know, because there's a few movie companies around Ottawa and Toronto and that. Have you thought of trying to get into the theatrical?
I have, well, my biggest problem is that I don't really have time to do that. I have a friend who is working on a play that involves a great deal of fencing, and if she gets funding for it, then she has said she would like to hire me to do the choreography for that, which would be really cool, and I would very much enjoy working on that. But there are a number of people in Ottawa. There's a gentleman named John Brogan, who is really, really good. Chris McLeod. They're both really excellent theatrical combat. Fight choreographer. Yeah, and they're really good, and they actually teach fight choreography and teach people how to do theatrical combat, and they've run programs sharing space from Ottawa Swordplay.
Mm-hmm.
Also, the head instructor at Ottawa Swordplay, Craig Shackleton, is was an excellent fighter, and really his depth of knowledge, I would say, is probably greater than mine, although I would argue I have somewhat more breadth of knowledge than he does.
Okay. That's
and in fact, I would encourage you to add him, Craig, to your interview list. He's also a huge gaming nerd and, unlike me, has actually published adventures. So.
Oh, really? Okay, that's pretty... Yeah, I'll have to look him up then. Yep. It's good. And go back to the gaming then, because... for me, my gaming, I got an interest of history and other stuff like that from gaming, like, you know, the different Viking eras, all that sort of stuff. So I started reading the books of the culture and that, and also like the armor and stuff. So now I'm not as versed as you are, obviously, for the weapons, but a lot of the systems, when it comes down for the game mechanics for combat, it's they either go for like GURPS way in depth, or some like Pendragon, which is nice and easy. But mm-hmm. because it's hard when you start looking at different types of sword fights, or, you know, armor versus a weapon. Like a pickaxe is meant to go through most armor, right? A hammer is warhammer is supposed to just bludgeon it. So when you're gaming in that, does that sometimes, like, you know, you're like, well, that doesn't make sense that this weapon can't do this, or this weapon should do more damage or less damage?
That's a really good question. In general, I'm pretty good at suspending my disbelief.
Okay. I was going to say, because crossbows, like that, one of the ones I've always disliked in D&D and other games is crossbows. They were meant to be at short range. They would go through pretty much any armor anyone was wearing. Leather armor is one of the ones that actually, you know, padded leather actually sort of held because it, you know, slowed down the bolt, I guess, enough, but metal armor didn't do anything to it. So it was like, okay, if you don't have a shield and you're walking towards a guy with a crossbow, you're going to get hit, and it's going through you. That's where.
Well, I mean, in the end, historically, people wear armor because it protects them from getting hurt.
Mm-hmm.
That's why we have armor, and a lot of so coming at it from a martial arts side of things, when you're looking at some of the more hand-to-hand martial arts, so things like boxing or karate or jiu-jitsu or anything that involves punching or grabbing people, those are things that are really easy to practice with other people, because if I hit somebody with a punch, or if I, you know, get somebody in an arm lock, I'm not gonna, as long as I'm reasonably careful, I'm not gonna permanently hurt them.
Right.
If I'm fighting with a sword or some other weapon that's really designed to kill people, I have to use an abstraction of combat when I'm fighting them, because I don't want to get hurt. I don't want my friend who I'm fighting with to get hurt.
Yes.
I want to be able to do this again because it's fun and I love it. So every club has a different kind of abstraction that they use to keep the people who are practicing the game safe. So, for example, for the SCA rattan combat, the armor is there to protect people. They use rattan swords. They have discussions about what level of calibration are used for the blows. And people fight while wearing armor, but with the assumption that they're wearing something that a sword could cut through.
Yeah.
There are people who do more...
Oh yes,
historically styled combats.
And isn't there new
arms and that sort of thing?
And where isn't there a new
is not necessarily to hit somebody hard enough that they are register the hit, but rather some of the more medieval styles where I'm going to hit you 10 times.
Right.
That's my or we're going to fight to 10 blows, and we're fighting for honor as opposed to a particular victory condition.
Yeah.
You have the historic medieval battles guys, or ACL Armored Combat League, and their goal is the fight's over when the other person surrenders or falls down and can't get up.
Yeah.
You have the SCA rapier rules, where you go for lightest positive pressure. So my goal is to touch the other person with my sword, ideally the tip, or a motion that represents cutting.
Mm.
And that is considered sufficient to indicate that I have successfully defeated their defenses and made the hit.
Yeah.
With Ottawa Swordplay, because it's not as large an organization, we have more ability to say, oh, you know what, I think that was maybe not good, or this is the sort of level of intent that I want to see in a hit before it would be called good.
Yeah.
In the HEMA tournaments, generally those are judged. So the participants are trying to strike the other person, and the judge calls whether the blow was good or not. And sometimes there's multiple judges. Same in non-electronic Olympic-style fencing. You have judges that call the blows.
Mm-hmm.
Olympic-style fencing, of course, you have the electronic triggers that register hits.
Yeah.
So if you take all that and think about all of those different abstractions and then look back at what the various role-playing games do, again, it's all an abstraction. D&D has all kinds of hit points.
Yeah.
You have systems like, as you say, Pendragon is a very interesting system as well. We have GURPS, very nitty gritty and realistic.
Yeah.
You have things like Warhammer,
where
you have these insane critical hit tables where, you know, someone's arm can get ripped off and they instantly bleed to death as all the blood explodes out of their body.
Yes.
Right? So all of these things are an abstraction of what someone feels like either real combat or fantasy combat should be like. And mm-hmm. if we go back to looking at theatrical combat, what we're trying to do in these role-playing games is tell a story.
Yes.
And to be honest, stories where you're mugged in the street, you get stabbed and bleed to death before you even get to the bar to meet the rest of the people in your party,
they're not
are
fun.
Not interesting stories to participate in.
No, you're right. You want to be the hero who goes through the, like, the, you know, in the Bruce Lee movies, you're the guy who goes through the mobs without, you know, well, you'll take damage, but you'll still be at the end alive.
Yeah, and to be honest, I really like that, bringing that concept into the game where you have mooks, I think is what, who uses that term? Not Legend of the Five Rings. No. Feng Shui.
Feng Shui, yes.
Where they came up with the term mooks, and you have the idea of you have the boss level and the entry level, and one's easier to deal with than the other.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a really, really great concept for role-playing games, because that's the frame of reference that we're using when we're playing these games, is we are the hero in a movie or a TV series,
yeah,
or a novel or a comic book.
Yeah, no, I understand. The other one that has it is Deadlands has the same idea. It's like if they're not important, they have just so many hits total, and that's it. They, you do that, they're down. Whereas the important bosses are similar to the heroes. They have different wound levels. They can, you know, mm-hmm. they can buy back wounds, so all of a sudden that didn't actually do as much damage as you thought. So yeah, that shows like you're at the boss level. They're similar to you, so here it comes.
Yeah, Savage Worlds also does something similar, mm-hmm. where you have your low-level characters who are either up or they're not up, at which point they've been defeated, but then you have the boss levels who are basically the same as a player character, mm-hmm. in terms of yeah. how they are able to fight.
So like I was saying, John, but, it's similar to D&D 3.5, where the NPCs now get to be similar to the PCs in abilities, what they call feats and stuff like that. So it's okay. Very, very similar, right? It's like, okay, you're up against the big boss. Whereas before in the original older D&Ds, they just gave them more hit points and made them tougher. Now,
yeah.
now they have abilities which can really hurt PCs. But you still want them to be able to win. Now, the question I was going to ask you...
Was one of the things that I really didn't like about the 4th edition D&D, was that they decided to have NPCs use and monsters use a completely different mechanic than the player characters.
Yes.
But that was a poor decision, in my opinion.
Stick it with the similar ones to the PCs, because then you don't have to think it's not extra work for the GM. I mean, it's still extra work to do all the extra background stuff, but... 5 actually does. I've looked at a little bit of 5, haven't actually played it, but from what I've seen, 5 goes back to the idea of 3 and 3.5, where the monsters are similar to the PCs for that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I was going to ask you, do you do any of your own blacksmith? Like, have you done blacksmithing or...
Okay, so I have never done any blacksmith. Okay, that's not true. I have done very limited blacksmith. I made something called an S-hook. There was...
What's an S-hook?
A friend of mine. I have a number of friends who are blacksmiths, and one of them was doing sort of impromptu classes. So I took a quick lesson to make an S-hook. An S-hook is just a piece of metal shaped into an S, and it's used for you hook one end over something, and then you can hang stuff.
Oh, okay. like the meat.
Basically, all it is. It's a hook that's shaped like an S.
Okay, so I guess a lot of butchers and stuff like that. I think I've seen them in the for hanging.
Sure. And you use them for hanging cook pots over a fire if you have a tripod over it, or hanging stuff up in the kitchen, that sort of thing.
And I know you don't have very much time, but would that be something that you'd be interested in, or you're just
the big reason that I'm in the SCA is the maker culture aspect of it. So I like being able to make things. I like doing bone carving and leather working and book binding and making costumes and shoes and weaving and metal casting.
Oh, wow.
I think I said earlier the idea of medieval material culture.
Mm-hmm.
So the big event that we had yesterday was our Kingdom ANS event.
Tell us about that one.
Yeah. That was before we turned on the Skype. So we had a big event locally yesterday, which is our Kingdom ANS. So the SCA is a global organization, and it's divided into kingdoms. And Ontario is one kingdom because of how it worked out.
Okay.
And I play a lot because I live in Ontario.
Yeah.
So that's the group I play with. And most kingdoms have some sort of... ANS, which stands for Arts and Sciences, which is people who are looking at specific recreation of aspects of medieval culture. So frequently at these events, I will do a presentation or a class talking about some aspect of medieval martial arts. But I didn't do any of that yesterday because I was...
Yeah,
I was busy with other things, but there were all kinds of really fascinating projects there, from people who had made armor to people who did book binding to people who did jewelry making to people who did musical presentations, people who wrote period style drinking songs, all kinds of really cool stuff.
Yeah, and
so
I've had some of your beer that was like from original recipes of
that would be another aspect of material culture, which is really awesome. I have a number of friends who are really good brewers, which is certainly an advantage.
It also helps with gaming too, right?
A little bit of libation is always good.
My regular
gaming group is just actually up the street from Tooth and Nail Brewery. Like, it's less than a block away. So
frequently
I stop there on the way.
I'm sure they're happy to see you as a good returning customer.
Oh, yeah. I don't know. I don't know if they recognize me, but the beer there is, I don't know if you have tried Tooth and Nail yet, but the beer is very good.
Okay.
And they just released a new one, which is a dark beer that has been aged in bourbon barrels.
That actually sounds quite good.
It's a dark, strong beer. It's really, really tasty. I had it for the first time last night, and I highly recommend it. But and they have Ontario beers, until recently, have had a strong tendency to not be very interesting. So the fact that there are they talk about some interesting stuff. Well, we're going to make a stout. We're going to put some licorice in it. They don't really ramp it up enough that you can taste it, which, in my opinion, defeats the purpose. One of the nice things about living in Ottawa is that we're sort of right across the river.
Yes, there's a whole bunch.
And there's a number of lovely beer stores over there where you can buy some of the Quebec microbrews, which are amazing.
Oh yeah, I try to go there once in a while.
Bring any of that back across the border into Ontario, because of course that's not allowed.
Okay. Actually, it is. If you're allowed to go there now and buy it. Yep. Yeah,
that's changed then.
It's only if you're trying to sell it back here, like. But if you're just bringing it for, because there's stuff there too. Yeah, because it's the microbrewery stuff we can't get here. So that's they've loosened the laws for that. I think there's also a certain quantity you can bring, like not, 15 2-4s, but I think there's a quantity level that you have to bring back.
Interesting. I may have to look into that. Thank you for that information.
No worries. So for the SCA now, I mean, because I was back in university in the 80s, and I tried it for a little bit. But it was, when I saw yours recently, it seems to have expanded for the types of culture, because now it looks like there's some Vikings as well as different, the time periods have been expanded, should I guess to say.
I think, maybe less. The SCA has always been, the official standpoint is pre-17th century. So anything up to basically midnight, December 31st, 1599.
Okay.
That's kind of the cutoff date.
But is there an earlier one? Like, you could be a Roman?
Not officially.
Okay.
And there are actually some people who do really, really good Roman. There's early period Anglo-Saxons and such like that. But in general, people kind of focus between 1600 and 600. It's kind of the time range that a lot of people look at. There's a huge 14th century contingent. Sometimes they like to call themselves the 14th century mafia, trying to convince people. There's a large group of Vikings, which has its pluses and minuses, given that Viking is a culture that is... There are a lot of white supremacists who try to co-opt Viking culture and European martial culture as well, which is very frustrating as someone who's interested in both those things.
Yeah, I understand. It's sort of like, no, we're not Anglos. We're not trying to be white supremacists. We want the Viking culture itself was quite interesting, with their gods and all that.
And in fact, was very non-supremacist in that way.
Yeah.
So,
well, they had lots of women rights. They did trading with anyone,
Yep.
Because that's the thing, people are like, oh, they raided and they killed. Like, well, they did a lot more than that. They brought trade to a lot of places. They had a lot more equal rights allowed than for Europe for the longest time. And so.
Yep. Yeah, no, it's Viking culture has got some really interesting stuff in it, and I don't know nearly enough about it to talk about it intelligently.
No, that's a word. That's what I found interesting, that it's, because for me, I always thought the SCA was more like just, the 13 to 1500s, that sort of time frame and that, but now I'm realizing it's quite a larger range.
Well, now, as I said earlier, I got into the SCA because I was looking for a group to do historical sword fighting with. Mm-hmm. And at the time, they were the only game in town. And from there, I got interested in, I need to look good while I'm out there.
Right.
Because why wouldn't you want to look good?
Yeah,
I started getting into sewing. And then from sewing, you start, what other things? You start making other eras and you're in like... Well, okay, this is all right, but I need the accessories if I want to look really good.
So the leather making.
Start learning how to make other things or finding other sources for things or doing research. And there's just so much. And the one of the nice things is that a lot of these are things that you don't need a lot of tools, like a lot of big expensive tools to be able to do. I mean, you're not going to be able to successfully do excellent bone carving the first time you try.
No.
Right? But the nice thing about bone carving, for example, is that I can go to the store and I can buy some beef bones for $3, and I can go over to Lee Valley and I can get a nice carving knife for $7. And
there you go. Yeah.
After I finish making a nice bone broth, I've got a bunch of clean bones that I can carve to my heart's content. Yeah. And learn a new skill and practice doing something neat without a whole lot of cost cost outlay.
Yeah.
Because the tools that we have access to now to make the tools that they would have used are much, 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 much more accessible.
Yes.
So I don't have to sell a whole cow to get a nice knife, because I don't have to worry about finding the smith who has managed to find an iron bloom to refine that into. That being said, there are some people who do that. In fact, one of the best experts on Viking metallurgy is a guy named Daryl Markowitz, and he lives down near Kitchener, I think.
Oh, so he's within your kingdom.
Yeah, no, he's. I know people who have contacted the museums over in Sweden and saying, "I'm trying to find out some information on these things." I'm like, oh yeah, no, you should probably. Well, we're going to refer you to this other guy. His name's Daryl. You should talk to him.
Really?
Yeah. I know him.
Oh, wow.
So yeah, it's pretty cool.
That's pretty impressive. That's just it. Like, the study is a whole bunch of different type of things, and it sounds very interesting. And I can know I've been to a couple. My friend Devram has been to a couple as well. The other one I asked was, have you ever partaken in the Grand Melee? Because I know that's something that happens as well. Like, it's a
So the big event I think that you're referring to is Penzic.
Penzic, that's
and funny. That's yeah. Penzic is the biggest SCA event in the world. It happens in Slippery Rock, Pennsylvania, usually around the long weekend in August, and it's 2 weeks. And there's usually somewhere between 11,000 and 13,000 people there.
Wow!
And with the rattan combat, they will have melee battles with upwards, you know, like 1,500 people on a side.
Well, that's and crazy.
I have watched them. I have never participated in one of those. The largest fight that I've participated in with the rattan combat is, maybe 200 people.
That's still a fair amount. Now, are the rules?
It's a fair amount. It's a big thing, and I've done melees with rapier with probably maybe 300 people.
Wow. That's...
But to be honest, I don't enjoy those very much. The rapier was not a battlefield weapon, and
no.
Trying to have a bunch of people use it as one, it's not my bag.
The what I'm wondering about is, like, so you have, well, you basically have, like, sort of, like, I guess, call them rules, if you will, for when you're doing the one-on-one combat, right? Because it's, you know, mm-hmm. if you get hit, it's supposed to be an arm loss or a limb loss, I think, right?
Yeah, so, and again,
yeah.
different clubs have different abstractions, but yeah, in the SCA, they have a tradition of fighting on while being unable to use the limb that was struck. If you are struck in a limb, or if you get hit in the head or the body, then that's it, you're done.
Yeah. Now, do those same rules or abstractions applied in the Grand Melees in that, or is there different
Yeah, sets? Absolutely. There are a couple of additional rules that are added for safety. And those usually refer to field of vision. So, you know, if you attack somebody from behind, that can be super dangerous.
Right, because they're not aware of
so
it and everything.
There are rules about how you have to let somebody know that you're behind them before you hit them, or give them an opportunity to let them know that you're behind them. So there is a couple of death from behind rules, or sometimes just, no, you don't get to do that in this fight.
That makes sense.
But other than that, the basic rule set is the same for single versus larger teams.
Okay. Now, going back to what somebody said about for head hits, because that's an interesting point, because I remember, well, you try not to hit the head, but in the helmets, you wear helmets which are padded and that. But now with all the stuff coming out for concussions and CTEs and all this sort of, you know, long-term effects for head injuries, is the SCA looking more into trying to eliminate any possibility of head hits at all, or...?
No, head hits are still allowed, and to be honest, it's usually the best place to hit somebody, because it's usually the best protection that they have is on their heads. The biggest risk for that sort of thing tends more to be, I think they're called whiplash concussions,
okay,
where somebody gets struck in the face and knocked backwards and their head jerks back, or they're knocked to the ground and they slam their head on the ground.
Yes.
Those are the two things that, in my experience, tend to be more likely to give someone a concussion than actually just hitting them in the head,
yeah,
with your weapon, because you're not hitting that hard.
True. And like the helmets, I remember from when I was wearing them, they do encase the head very well. Like there's not.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And there has been a lot of discussion lately about how the helmet should be inspected and what people should be looking for and how people should be padding their helmets to make sure that they are safe for the type of fighting that we do.
Do you guys wear mouth guards?
I think that's a great conversation that people are having.
Yeah. Do you guys wear mouth guards? Cause they've shown mouth guards help reduce the risk of,
I am not aware of people who wear mouth guards. Okay. Although if I were to start getting back into the rattan combat, I would probably be looking at getting one.
Yeah, I know it's not quite realistic.
Right now, I have a back injury right now, and I haven't been able to fight for about 6 months.
Ouch.
So, yeah, it really sucks.
Yeah, especially because you do a lot of activities as well, so this is probably very frustrating for you for not to be able to, like, not just the fighting, but...
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I still get to do some teaching with Ottawa Swordplay, but it's...
little bit more limited.
Some days are better than other days with that sort of thing.
All right. Well, I think I'm going to let you go here, John, because I know you're going to have some time in that. But I want to thank you very much for... don't hang up after this when I say goodbye. It's going to be the end of the
podcast. Yeah.
But thank you very much for the really good conversation here and a lot of good information. Hopefully our listeners will enjoy and give them ideas to look at for you. Anything else you want to say before we head off?
No, thank you very much. It was great. I love talking about this stuff, and I'm glad I was able to find some time to be able to share it with you and your listeners.
Right. Thanks, John.